This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey guys, coming up on today's episode of the Offscript podcast, we've got big guests aplenty. We're going to start with the Swiss explorer Bertrand Piccard, a man who has circumnavigated the globe in a hot air balloon and a solar-powered plane. Remarkable stuff. Lovely insight from Bertrand into how he went about those two incredible expeditions. We're also in conversation with two inventors who won the Earthshot Prize and £1 million to boot. And we're speaking to the unified light welterweight world champion, Josh Taylor, a boxer who is going places, and he's already sat atop the world. Enjoy the podcast.
The Offscript Podcast.
The big interview with Offscript.
Let's give you some of the top lines here about Bertrand Piccard and what he's done. So along with Brian Jones, he was the first person to complete a nonstop balloon flight around the globe. That was the Breitling Orbiter 3. He was also the initiator and pilot, that's along with Andre Borschberg, of Solar Impulse. You might have heard of it because it actually made its headline tour starting from and ending
that's
in
right.
Abu Dhabi.
Yes, it did.
Yes, this was the first successful around-the-world solar-powered flight, purely solar-powered. There were no backup reserves of fuel here that they had just in case things didn't work out. And since then, he started the Solar Impulse Foundation to select innovative solutions for environmental crises and to promote them to decision makers. So he's found more than 1,000 different projects and initiatives that are not just good for the environment, but that make economic sense as well.
Fantastic.
So good investment opportunity. So he's got so many different things going on here. We're going to start with the first two today. We're going to bring you the environmental piece a little bit later because there's just so much to get through. Before we get to all of this, we need to talk a little bit about his unique lineage because he is from generations of legendary explorers. The Piccard family has this distinction. They have broken world records for both the highest flight and the deepest dive.
Oh, wait.
When I asked him about this, Bertrand actually said there was only one way for him to go, horizontal.
Horizontal.
And that's why he had to make his trips around the world. So his grandfather, Auguste Piccard, was a balloonist and undersea explorer. He had twice beaten the record for reaching the highest altitude in a balloon. This was between 1931 and 1932. He was also known for his invention of the first bath escape for deep sea exploration. Okay, so that's his grandfather. Now, his grandfather's twin brother Jean-Félix and his wife Jeanette were also record-breaking balloonists. Jeanette was the first woman to fly to the stratosphere.
Yeah, second lowest layer of Earth's atmosphere.
Yep. And Bertrand's father, Jacques Piccard, meanwhile, was an undersea explorer.
Yeah.
So in the Challenger Deep, he was among the first people to explore the deepest part of the world's ocean,
Mariana Trench.
Yeah, wow.
Wow, the Piccard.
So that was his father and
big
grandfather.
Big shoes to fill.
He had no choice, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. There's only one way to go. So I did ask him about the conversations at the dinner table, because what is it like when your family is that level of explorers and everybody's doing something so interesting and unique? Were his father and grandfather always sharing their stories?
Yes, absolutely. But you know what was very strange was that for the family, it was normal. For my brother, my sister and me, we were hearing all these stories all the time. And we thought the entire world is made out of explorers. And it was, of course, not the case. But my father was telling us, for example, that his only fear when he went down to the Mariana Trench with the Batiscafe was the fact that something would prevent him to go down to the depth and he would be obliged to come to the surface before the end of the dive. So he was not afraid of something for him. He was just afraid of something that would prevent him to go deeper. And then he was telling me also about the importance of this dive because he saw a fish at 11 kilometers down. And that was the proof that there was life, there was oxygen, there were currents in the water in a time where the governments wanted to throw the radioactive and toxical waste in the deepest trenches. So his dive was a big, major milestone for the protection of the oceans. And since then, it became prohibited to drop radioactive waste in the oceans.
And I always think of that stat. We know less about the bottom of the seafloor than we do about outer space.
Yeah, right? Isn't that wild? And I actually didn't know that part of the story. I had heard, obviously, of Jacques Picard and the Mariana Trench. But the idea that because he could prove there was life down there had a direct consequence on regulation and what we were able to dump into the sea, that was a piece of it that I had no idea until today. So I did. Before we get into Bertrand's own explorations and journeys, I wanted to learn a little bit more about his own relationship with fear.
I understood very early, very young, something important. Fear is like a life insurance, you know. It just tells you, be careful, you're going out of your comfort zone. And this obliges you to be more aware, to be more performant, to be more creative. You know, this is really a signal that makes you more connected to yourself and to the present moment. And I discovered that when I was flying hang gliders at the age of 16. I was a really young boy. I saw a hang glider in the very early beginning of that sport in Europe. And I thought, that's for me. I want to explore this. And I became really good in flying. I became much more aware of the responsibility I had for my life, you know, just to do the right thing to avoid some accidents. And I thought, we must be able to master our fear. We must be able to concentrate better, to be more responsible, to be more aware of what we are doing. And it helped me a lot in life because, you know, I'm not a daredevil. I'm not somebody who likes to be afraid. I'm just somebody who knows that we can master fear in a very good way.
So it's just a little bit about his mindset. But back in 1999, Bertrand and Brian Jones made history when their Breitling Orbiter 3 completed the first nonstop balloon trip around the world. It was something that many had achieved before, and they were the first to successfully do this.
That's amazing.
Now, I want to start, though, when we say balloon trip, what does that mean? Because when I think of hot air balloon, I think of Cappadocia.
Yeah.
You know, I think of
I went
little,
in one.
Yeah, I think
it's
of the July. Basket with a colorful balloon, right? I mean, what do you guys think when you think of
these? Yeah, so that was my only, doing the Masai Mara earlier this year was my only experience of it. And it was absolutely incredible. And one thing that I realized that I didn't know and had no conception of is how much it moves laterally or it moves forward. It has forward propulsion. I thought it would just go kind of up and down,
right.
But it really doesn't. It travels, you know, along the ground. You can see the ground passing underneath you
along
quite fast.
Along with the wind currents, right? In
exactly.
The jet streams.
Yeah.
So this, I had a little look at a photo of the Breitling Orbiter 3. Now, it's nothing like what you went on safari, of course. As you would imagine, it's actually, it looks a little bit more like a capsule. So the gondola is constructed of a weave of Kevlar and carbon fiber material. It's bright pink, and it's got these little window holes. And in fact, after launching, the cabin was sealed at 6,000 feet to trap the air within it.
Right.
So it's much more high-tech instrument or aircraft, as you
might
imagine.
Yeah, you are rather high, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So they, at an altitude of 36,000 feet, their balloon past the finish line over Mauritania. It was the same longitude from which they had began their voyage about 20 days before that. And the trip had taken them over Europe, Africa, Asia, the Pacific Ocean, Central America, and the Atlantic Ocean as well. So I asked Bertrand about the most challenging aspects of this journey.
It had never been done before, which means that nobody can explain you how to do it. You need to invent a new type of balloon, a new strategy, new ways to do it. And it was very exciting because it was a big race with Richard Branson, with Steve Fossett. There were big billionaires from around the world. I was the only one as a Swiss citizen who was not the billionaire in the race, and we won. And it was very interesting because, you know, the balloon that had flown the longest until then had flown 6 days. And the winds take 3 weeks to go around the world. So we really needed a new type of balloon that could stay airborne much longer and use the wind in the right direction. Because if you don't have the right direction, you end up in the North Pole or the South Pole. You don't go around the world. So it was a lot of preparation. But once in the air, it was a lot of adaptation and resilience because you need to change your altitude in order to take the best wind. Sometimes to go more to the left or more to the right, you have to fly higher or lower. So you really play with the winds. And we did it together with my friend Brian Jones. And we stayed 20 days in the air nonstop. And I tell you, it was beautiful just to be pushed by the wind, to live inside nature in our little bubble of gas going in the atmosphere around the world.
Bertrand Picard sounds like an adventurer.
Yes.
Brian Jones sounds like a plumber.
Harsh.
There you are.
Harsh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Or like the front man of like
Bertrand Picard,
60s or 70s.
Adventurer, explorer. Yeah. Brian Jones.
Plumber.
All right.
Now, this is a journey that we mentioned other people had attempted. And Bertrand and Brian were the first to successfully complete it. So I asked him if there were any moments that they realized things weren't quite going to plan or even felt that their lives might be at risk.
You know, at every moment, there were difficulties. For example, when we had finished the crossing of the Pacific, we were above Mexico. The flight had been much longer than we thought. And actually, we had 1/8 of the fuel left to make 1/4 of the flight left. So when you make the calculation, it doesn't work. We still had the Atlantic and Africa to cross, and there was almost no fuel left. And I remember with Brian Jones, we thought, we go. We take the risk. Because even if we ditch, okay, we will survive. We'll lose the balloon, but we'll survive. But if we make a safety landing in Mexico, for the rest of our life, we will think we failed. We failed, and maybe we should have tried. But the winds were not good. We were going too much to the south. And I remember I had to go the highest as possible, pushing the balloon almost to the limit in altitude to find a better wind that took us back on track. So nothing could be taken for granted until the last moment.
How do you do that, though? When you talked about how little fuel you had left with a quarter of the journey still to go, I mean, you must have just been waiting to run out at any time. And what happens when you just run out of fuel on a hot air balloon? Do you slowly descend? I mean, what if you were over water at that period of time? I'm so interested in how you navigate a challenge like that.
If you run out of fuel, you fall down. You fall down from the sky because you cannot heat your balloon anymore. But you know what saved us? It's the fact that we could find a very, very powerful jet stream. Over Mexico, it was very, very slow. We thought we're not going to make it. We're going to ditch the Atlantic, but we try nevertheless. We really try everything we can. And then the following day, we hit a jet stream that was 131 knots. So it's 234 kilometers per hour. Can you imagine that? And there was no speed cameras. And we crossed the Atlantic in a day and a half. That was the fastest time of our flight. And it was the moment where we needed it really badly. So it was almost like a miracle.
The famous jet stream, yeah, the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, 42,000 kilometers in just 20 days. And he said the Atlantic there in 1.5 days.
Wow.
Insane when you think about it. And of course, Bertrand, as you can tell from his personality, is not one to rest on his laurels, because not long after that successful landing, his brain is already starting to tick and work on the next challenge.
When I landed with Breitling Orbiter 3 in the Egyptian desert, after having gone all the way around the world, 45,000 kilometers, there was 40 kilos left of propane gas, out of the 3.7 tons that we had for the takeoff. So when you hear that the sky is the limit, it's wrong. The sky is not the limit. The fuel is the limit. And I thought that if I wanted to invent a new cycle in the history of aviation, I had to try something without fuel. Because with fuel, it went from the Wright brothers to the moon landing, to the Concorde, to supersonic flight. But, okay, this needs a lot of fuel. And I wanted to see what could be done without fuel. And this was the beginning of the dream of Solar Impulse. A plane with solar cells on the wing, with the possibility to transform the energy of the sun into electricity, to feed electric engines, and store the energy of inside the batteries in order to fly at night when there was no sun. So theoretically, it was a perpetual flight. Because if you can make one cycle day and night, you can make as many as you want.
And that was how the idea for Solar Impulse started. It's a long-range experimental solar-powered aircraft project. They set out with this goal to make the first circumnavigation of the Earth by a piloted fixed-wing aircraft using only solar power. And that means no reserves, no fuel reserves, just in case. Mm. Absolutely,
what if it's cloudy?
Purely solar. So, I mean, obviously, they had to manage and navigate around that and plan for it. So we will talk about that, because they had to create a certain way of flying in order to make this work, because it's not like they could charge their batteries off the flight. All of the solar powered energy had to come from the plane itself. So Solar Impulse 1 was a bit of a prototype. They did some test flights. Solar Impulse 2 was completed in 2014, and it had a unique sort of structure to it, because you can imagine the wingspan was so big that it's almost the same wingspan of an A380. That's how large it is, and that's so all the solar panels could sit on the top of it. But at the same time, the carriage or the actual cabin was incredibly small. So you think of an A380's cabin as something like 500 tons. This cabin was like 2 tons. It was, they had to make sure it was as efficient as possible. So on the 9th of March, Picard and his co-pilot, Andre Borschberg, started their circumnavigation departing from Abu Dhabi, in fact. Do you guys remember this?
I do remember it. I think
it was
on our show. They weren't on our show until now, of course, in the case of Bertrand, but I'm pretty sure we were live with Off Script when this happened, because I can remember vividly talking about it on this very show.
It couldn't have been, because it was 2015.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember talking about it then.
We might have subsequently talked about it tonight.
Yeah. Wow. So he did say that the UAE and Abu Dhabi has a special relationship with Masdar in particular. So he said it was the perfect place, really, to start and end the journey. And the launch went smoothly, as they could have hoped.
These are live pictures of Solar Impulse 2 leaving Abu Dhabi.
Confirm the authorization to take off.
Yes, coordinated with the tower.
Get ready for this, the takeoff of Solar Impulse 2 on the beginning of the round-the-world flight attempt from Abu Dhabi to Amman for the first leg. Once the engines are run up and the plane starts moving, it will literally take a few seconds before the plane is in the air.
From there, they would fly and glide in certain ways to use their batteries tactically. Because as I mentioned, it wasn't like they could take the batteries out, charge them on the ground. It had to be completely based on what they could generate on the plane itself. So the plane traversed Asia. In July 2015, it completed a long leg of its journey from Japan to Hawaii. They had a bit of a battery issue, so they had to do some repairs. So from there, they went on to California and then to New York City, crossed the Atlantic to Spain, stopped in Egypt, and then eventually returned to Abu Dhabi on the 26th of July 2016. So it took more than 16 months all in all to make that journey, 42,000 kilometers. The first circumnavigation of the Earth using only solar power on a fixed airwing plane, of course. And in order to make this journey on such low consumption, part of this was that they weren't actually co-piloting together. They were taking turns.
There was only one pilot flying at the time. So when I was flying, my friend Andre Borschberg was on the ground. When Andre was flying, I was on the ground with the team. And we stopped when we were flying over Asia, we stopped every day. But above the oceans, the flights were 3 days, 5 days and nights in a row. And that was beautiful, you know, to fly for so long. You have the sunrise, you have the sunset, and you have no fuel. You know, you can fly forever.
Wait, so you are alone in the plane on those 3 or 5 day stretches. I mean, how do you sleep?
The plane had an autopilot, and we were allowed to sleep by little periods of 20 minutes. It's interesting because it's the first and only time that the civil aviation authorities gave the permission for a single pilot airplane to have the pilot sleeping on board. And we had to negotiate that. So this is why it was only 20 minutes period. And after 20 minutes, the pilot had to check if the direction was okay, the altitude, the speed. We made a report to the air traffic control from our control center in Monaco, and then 20 minutes more to sleep, but then there was the alarm again, controlling, checking everything. And I tell you, there was not a lot of sleep. When I flew from Egypt to Abu Dhabi on the last leg of the flight, there was 3 nights flying in a row, if you count the takeoff and the landing. And there was a lot of turbulence above Saudi Arabia. I could hardly sleep, so I think it's the moment of my life where I slept the smallest amount of sleep during 3 days. It was maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes per 24 hours.
I can't think of anything more frightening, not having slept for 3 days and setting an alarm for 20 minutes. I mean, there's no way I would sleep right through.
I can't conceive of that.
So he did say the thing about the adventure is you think you can't do it and then somehow you find a way. You just do. That's kind of what he said in response to that. Now, of course, a 16-month ambitious journey. How did he feel when he was landing on that final leg with Abu Dhabi in sight?
It was 15 years of my life to set up this adventure, to find the partners, to have a technical team that was led by André to build the plane. But 15 years of my life, it was really long, and there were so many setbacks and doubts and problems. I needed to be so resilient. So I tell you, in the last leg, when I had the lights of Abu Dhabi in front of me, it was dark night, just the lights of the city, maybe 100 kilometers from me. And I knew that if there was 1 meter missing, it would be a failure. I had to cross the line of the takeoff 1 year before. And there was such a concentration and such an emotion. And then very, very slowly, I arrived above Abu Dhabi. I crossed the finish line. And that was an incredible moment because I still had an hour and a half to turn above the city before landing to have the wind calming down. And I could speak to all the people of my team and thank them. And they were congratulating me. And there was the Prince of Monaco. And there was Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the UN. There was Sultan Al-Jaber from Masdar. There was the President of Switzerland. There were so many people online with me by satellite phone congratulating me. And there was no stress anymore. I had succeeded and I was still in the air. But then, of course, I had to land and I did not want to land. You know, I wanted to stay there for 4 hours because it was so beautiful. And then the control center told me, okay, now it's time for landing. And I made the landing perfectly. And then I stayed inside the cockpit. I did not want to get out immediately because I knew that as soon as the door would be open, it would be the end of the adventure.
There's actually so much more from Bertrand, and we'll get to that another day, because from there he started the Solar Impulse Foundation, specifically with the mission to find projects. And it's funny because it kind of ties into what we're talking about the next hour with the Earth Shot, but projects that would be both good for the environment, but at the same time, a smart investment decision in the long run. So he has been identifying more than 1,000 of those initiatives and different kinds of technologies, and then connecting them to decision makers to try to help implement them. So we will come to that in a future episode.
Amazing
of this show.
Story, that. Brilliant story. Bertrand Piccard, all he was missing was that upstairs bar on the A380.
I'm sure
they
found a way.
Asleep at the wheel. That is incredible. Yeah. Having a nap in the middle of the air, flying around the world. That's amazing. Incredible stuff from Bertrand Piccard. Second part of that interview coming very soon. More to come on the show.
The Offscript Podcast.
Now, the Earthshot Prize, did you see some of the headlines on this yesterday? Of course, it was created by the Duke of Cambridge to reward people trying to save the planet. So they awarded 5 inaugural winners in different categories, each of them receiving £1 million to further their efforts. So the event itself was quite interesting because I think there's a lot of criticism around sustainability, environmental events and how they're actually run. With this, they preempted that. No celebrities flew to London for the ceremony. No plastic was used to build the stage. Guests were asked to consider the environment as well when choosing an outfits. They wanted the whole thing to feel in the nature of what they're trying to achieve. The name, of course, reference to moonshot, the idea of getting a man to the moon in 10 years when that was announced by JFK. Of course, this is instead the Earth Shot.
Yeah,
so
I like
we will get to some of the other winners. But for now, the winner of the Clean R Air category, as Rob mentioned, went to Tukachar, which is based in India. And they have created a portable machine created to turn agricultural waste into fertilizers so that farmers do not burn fields and cause air pollution.
Brilliant.
So pleased to say that we have Kevin Kung and Vidyat Mohan, co-founders of Tukachar, on the line with us now. I'll start by saying good evening to Kevin.
Good evening. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Vidya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
I mean, first of all, we have to start with a massive congratulations. Yeah. I mean, how does it feel to win on such a global stage for a project that you've conceived of and executed like this?
Well, I think, first of all, we are very, very humbled by the experience and the journey. And there are many, many very different, very well-qualified solutions that we've been interacting with. And it's a great network to be part of and really bring public attention to this very important issue of crop burning and its effect on air pollution.
Vidya, can you talk a little bit about the event, if possible? It was obviously star-studded. We had the likes of David Attenborough, Cate Blanchett, Shakira as well. Was it all a virtually conducted event? Were you there in person? Can you describe how it all kind of went down for you?
Yes. So all the finalists were invited to a location in the respective location, in the respective cities or areas where they're based. And there was a TV set up in front of us where we could see the live event, and there was a production crew waiting. And if we got to know that we won, then essentially the production crew would kick in and we would be live on TV and beamed on the screen, and then we would have to make a speech and accept the award.
Vidya, tell us a little bit about your project, Clean Takachar, and the current problem with agricultural waste that you were seeing. I mean, how did the idea for this even come about?
So, I grew up in Delhi, and air pollution is a big problem here. And some of the statistics are pretty shocking, that the open burning of agricultural waste contribute up to 25% of the smog. And the air pollution in total can reduce the life expectancy by up to 9 years. And having studied biomass technology in university, I was really curious to work on this problem, and got together with Kevin when he was also in university, because both of us were interested in the same area. And that's how the project was conceptualized.
Kevin, I'll come to you on this one. Give us then a kind of long and short, in layman's terms, talk us through your solution and how it works.
Sure. So most of the crop and forest residues are very loose, wet, and bulky, which makes it very difficult to handle or centralize for downstream conversion. So what we do is that we develop small-scale, low-cost portable systems that can latch onto the back of tractors and pickup trucks, and that can actually be deployed to rural farms to locally upgrade and densify the residues on site before any kind of transportation. And by doing so, for each truckload, we can greatly increase the amount of value that can be loaded onto it, and therefore reducing a lot of the logistical and handling costs, making a lot of the rural kind of biomass residues economical for conversion for the first time.
I was going to ask, Vidya, how is it affordable by these guys, and how ultimately are you going to scale it so that it has a sort of demonstrable impact on the entire country?
The idea of our entire design philosophy was to make small-scale, low-cost equipment since the beginning, so that we are able to make it affordable to rural communities and minimize the upfront costs. So we design it in such a way that it can be manufactured, repaired locally in and around villages itself, and that reduces the cost drastically.
Kevin, one last one for you. You were talking about the air pollution there. I mean, what kind of impact is this actually going to have on the air pollution? Because it's hard to imagine. You're talking about farmers using this kind of tool to increase their efficiency and help with logistics. But how is that having a direct impact on air pollution in any kind of scale that's going to make a difference?
Sure. So in many major cities, such as Delhi or Beijing, sometimes there is very significant smog, seasonal smog. And important contributor of that actually comes from farmers in the surrounding vicinity burning the crop residues after harvest, because they often only have a very limited amount of time to clear their land before the next planting. And often, since biomass is so expensive to truck out, burning that sort of on site is their only kind of viable solution. So for our solution, what we could do is to work with those farmers and convert it into higher value products that actually earns farmer extra income. And by doing so, the expectation is that a lot of the farmers will choose to use this process, which is clean. I mean, it's been shown in the lab to be at least 98% cleaner in terms of pollutants compared to the status quo. And if they do so, then that could potentially cut down a lot of the pollution that's associated with burning crop residues.
Fidget, last one for me as well. £1 million you guys have won, and congratulations, by the way, because it is an incredible achievement. Where does that money go? I'm hoping you're ring fencing just a small portion of it to have a right good party.
We will definitely get together as a team and a party for sure. But the funds will be used to scale beyond our interventions and working with farmers in places such as India, East Africa, and the US. And with the goal of reaching up to 30 million farmers by 2030.
Wow. That's fantastic, guys. Kevin, Vidya, it's brilliant to have you on our show. Thank you so much for sparing the time to have a little chat with us. And best of luck in really taking this global.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Massive thanks to the guys, Kevin and Vidyat, co-founders Incredible. Of Takacha, winner of the recent Earthshot Prize, and now £1 million upon which to spend in its kind of rollout.
I love that. You heard it there from Vidyat, 30 million by 2030. I mean, the guys, I doff my cap. That is incredible. Two individuals doing their bit for the environment. Incredible, guys. Well done.
The Off Script Podcast.
I'm in our exclusive interview with history-making boxer Josh Taylor.
Yes, the Scots, affectionately known as the Tartan Tornado, wrote his name into the record books back in May as he beat Jose Ramirez by unanimous decision to unify the light welterweight division. In doing so, becoming just the fifth man in history to clean up all four belts in a single weight class.
Before the break, we actually heard from Josh on his own career and why a date with Terence Crawford is his ultimate ambition. But what of Josh's thoughts on something we've been talking an awful lot about of late, the recent big heavyweight bouts involving Anthony Joshua and Alexander Usyk, as well, of course, as Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder.
Indeed, yeah, fascinating stuff on the way. But first, it was you, in actual fact, Rob, you wanted to find out, as a world champion boxer, as Josh is, he's a history maker, for goodness sake, which performance did he admire more? Usyk's surgical dismantling of Anthony Joshua or Fury's blood and guts victory over Wilder?
I'm not too sure. They're both quite equally impressive. One on Usyk's hand, because of the sheer size difference and the boxing ability and the concentration that he could just stick to that game plan for the full 12 rounds and just box him and move him and outmaneuver him, was very good levels of concentration and focus, which I was impressed with again. But I always felt that Usyk was a better boxer than Joshua. He's very easily outboxed Joshua. He's always struggled with people that can box and move a little bit. So I kind of knew that was going to be a factor in the fight. But the Fury fight, again, that had had everything in it. You know, it had the blood and glory in it. You know, they were both sort of beaten up. They were both on the deck. You know, they were both on the back sides. Both hurt in the fight, you know, and I had a little bit of everything, you know, so it was a very, very entertaining fight, and the both of them showed massive guts and determination and heart of lions, you know, absolute lions. So I would say the Fury fight was a better, more entertaining one to watch, but they were both quite equally impressive. I was actually impressed with Wilder's heart and determination to continue for that long in the fight, when he looked so tired from so early on in the fight, and he never threw the towel, and he dug in deep and kept digging and digging and digging until he finally got stopped, which was impressive in its own right, because he never gave up. He kept coming and coming and trying his best. So I would say the Fury fight was a better, more entertaining one to watch, but they were both impressive.
Yeah, that Fury bandwagon seems to be getting bigger and bigger with each passing fight, for good reason. He's put on not one, not two, but three incredible fights against Deontay Wilder. Are you among those of us on board that bandwagon? I mean, give me your take. Robbie and I often talk about in our show over here in Dubai, recentism. It's a bit easy to start saying, hey, listen, he's right up there with the very best heavyweights that we've seen. I've even seen some well-known journalist, for goodness sake, make the comparison with a Muhammad Ali. I mean, are we going there? From what you see, and again, you're a world champion, you know the game better than most. Is Tyson Fury as good as what some of us would have the wider public believe?
Well, I've said it for years and years that he's the best heavyweight in the division for a long, long time. I think even before he started, just before he boxed Klitschko, there wasn't many people that says he could beat him. I was one of the people who said he could beat him because his adaptability, he can change, and he doesn't, he's got that kind of style. It's like, it's kind of like where he doesn't know what he's going to do himself yet. And it's unpredictable, you know, it's unpredictable, and he can change all the time. So I've said it for years and years that Fury is the best Furyweight, the best heavyweight in this generation. I've said it for years. I've always said that he's the best heavyweight. So I'm not surprised that he's getting tagged as number one, but he is the best heavyweight of this generation for sure. That fight there, that trilogy goes down as one of the best trilogies in recent history as well. You know, it's a massive achievement. He's a very, very good fighter. He's a superstar of the sport, that's for sure.
Do you think he would have an easy night fighting Anthony Joshua? Obviously, there's still a lot of public interest in that fight, despite the fact that, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, it was the fight. It was almost made were it not for the arbitration. And yet now it seems like a mismatch now because of what Fury's done and because of how comparatively outclassed Anthony Joshua was against Usyk. But yet there's still a demand to see those two in the square circle, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been on Team Fury on that fight, if or when it happens. But it's by no means a mismatch, certainly not. It's heavyweight boxing. It can only takes one punch, and those guys are like horses, you know. It's like getting kicked off a horse and being punched by one of these guys. They're big and strong men. So I've always been on Team Fury if that fight happens. I think he outboxes him. Joshua doesn't get anywhere near him with the boxing side. But if it comes to a fight and it's up in close quarters, Joshua is very good at close and mid-range with his uppercuts, his left hooks, and he's a good fast combination puncher. And I believe if Fury got hurt like that against Joshua, he could be in trouble, because Joshua's a very good finisher. When he smells the blood, he jumps on you, and he's quick with his hands, and he's very compact and powerful puncher. So it would be a very dangerous fight, and it's still an interesting fight to watch.
If you're looking at that crystal ball of yours, as Robbie says, you were ringside for the first AJ Usyk fight. We spoke to your trainer, Ben, at length about this yesterday. I was making the point that I must admit I've been fortunate enough to see AJ in the flesh a couple of times. He doesn't impress me. The jab for me is, it's not what a Lennox Lewis jab, for example, was. And I think Ruiz, it was powder puff. Ruiz went after him. Usyk as well felt it, went after him a little bit. I wonder, do you feel as a pro, and from what you solve that fight, do you feel that AJ's got the capabilities to make the adjustments to win the rematch like he did Ruiz, or is Usyk simply put just a better technician and a better boxer than AJ?
Yeah, he's a better technician, he's a better boxer, 100%. Joshua, in terms of boxing level and boxing skill, is not the best out there in terms of boxing ability. I think the reason he got there most of the time is due to his sheer size and strength in most of his fights.
Yeah.
And his athleticism in most of his fights come through. His size and his strength. His boxing ability is not the greatest. He's very basic. He's always struggled with people that can box a little bit. But having said that, he got there. He has a killer instinct. You know, he has got that killer instinct. When he had his opponents hurt, he jumps on them and he gets them out there. He's a very good finisher. He's a very, very good, strong, big guy, combination, strong puncher, carries the power through with all his punches. So I think in the rematch, if he does anywhere near what he did in the last time, the same, he gets beat again. And I said that on the night. If he boxes like anywhere like how he did that night, if they fought five times, he gets beat five times. But the only way I see Joshua winning that fight, and I think this is what he has to do the next time, is come out straight away and impose that size and strength. You know, come out, take the centre of the ring, press forward and put Usyk on the back foot from the outset, you know, cover up tight, let him take a couple of punches on the gloves and wear him out, let him out punch him and get close to him, manhandle him, sort of tie him up, wrestle him, hit him on the shoulders, hit him on the arms, hit him around the back, you know, use a little bit of dirty tactics, you know, you've got to do it. It's a fight at the end of the day. And tire Usyk out. And I think that's the way he can beat him, is by using his size and his strength and pressing on forward him right from the outset. But having said that, I don't think Joshua has the engine to do it, the stamina to maintain that for 12 rounds. I think he has to do that, come out and do that and impress him and then get him out there early on by five or six rounds. Or he otherwise sort of gases out again, which we've seen happen a lot of times.
But what of Josh's thoughts on something we've been talking an awful lot about of late, the recent big heavyweight bouts involving Anthony Joshua and Alexander Usyk, as well, of course, as Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder.
Indeed, yeah, fascinating stuff on the way. But first, it was you in actual fact, Rob. You wanted to find out, as a world champion boxer, as Josh is, he's a history maker, for goodness sake, which performance did he admire more? Usyk's surgical dismantling of Anthony Joshua or Fury's blood and guts victory over Wilder?
I'm not too sure what happened there. It was a little bit frustrating. I do feel, though, that if I'd been maybe from south of the border, there'd been a little bit more attention on me, a little bit more attention on the achievement that I'd just done and what I was trying to achieve, the greatness that I was trying to achieve. There would have been a little bit more attention on it. But I don't know. I think ultimately, mostly, it was down to because the coronavirus and, you know, the restrictions of the media that couldn't get out to America, things like that. But the fact that no TV, a British broadcaster picked up was sort of like a kick in the teeth. But, you know, we're here now, we've done it. I'm the first guy in Britain to become undisputed champion. I am the Doug's nuts, as they want to say. So the Mutt's nuts. So I am the man at the minute, and everybody knows it now. So I'm not really too fussed for it, but, you know, I'm not that kind of guy to sort of go out and crave the attention and the things like that. But, you know, maybe if I'd been somewhere else or someone else, it might be doing a little bit different. But, you know, they can't ignore me for too long. I've done so much now, I've achieved so much now that they can't ignore me.
And in reference to that, does the nonsense that's going on in boxing at the moment, the Jake Paul fights, for example, that are doing pay-per-view numbers when the guy's never fought a professional boxer, or even a boxer, let's be honest. Does that annoy you, Josh? Does that get under your skin? You
know, not really, but, you know, it is a little bit annoying. You know, you've got guys, you know, like myself, I've dedicated my whole life to boxing. You know, I've went through a lot of hardship to get to where I am. I've sacrificed a whole lot in my life growing up and coming up in my career. I've sacrificed a lot, you know, and gave my whole life to the sport. And then you've got two guys that, you know, that have never boxed in their life before. They fancy having a wee bit of a fight and putting on a show and kind of turning boxing into almost like a wrestling match and a circus, you know. And it's been a little bit frustrating that these guys are getting on top of these shows and they're putting on, getting paid a hell of a lot of money. And they're putting good fighters on their undercards and stuff like that, which is it's sometimes a little bit disrespectful. They're disrespecting the sport a little bit. But having said that, at the same time, they are bringing massive audiences to the sport. They're bringing new sets of eyes, new fresh eyes to it. You know, they're bringing huge numbers in terms of audiences and new sort of fans to the sport. So if some of these new kids that are watching them on YouTubes and whatever that they're doing, and some of them become genuine fans of the sport, then that can only be good for the sport to help it grow it. If someone said to me, if I wanted to be on one of the undercards, I would say, shove it where the sun don't shine, you know? Don't disrespect me like that.
Absolutely. I'm with you wholeheartedly on everything that you've just said there. And I wonder, Robbie's right to raise the interview you gave to Max Kellerman. That was just post Ramirez. Have those words led to any change, Josh? Have you seen, have more people now that you've kind of made history be knocking on your door where perhaps before the Ramirez fight they were not?
Yeah, I mean, since I got back, the media attention was pretty good. You know, I was up and down to London doing a lot of TV stuff, opening shops and doing a lot of interviews and things like that. So the media attention since I've been back has been a little bit, you know, it's been quite good. You know, it's been picked up a lot. You know, I've noticed my profile picking up a lot and getting asked to go here, there and everywhere. So it's picked up since I've been back home, you know. So, yeah, it's been good. But at the same time, I don't crave the attention, you know. I'm not in the sport to to get attention. I'm in the sport to win titles and be remembered as a great fighter. I'm not really too fussed for being a celebrity.
You said aspirations and achievements and goals still very much on the radar. You've unified the division. You're 18-0, Josh. There are names out there that have been talked about, of course. And I know you're probably in the very much the frame of mind where all you are focusing on right now is this fight against Jack Catterall. But there are some big names out there. I'm sure you know you'd love a fight with Terence Crawford one day. Is that just stating the obvious?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my longer term goals and ambitions is to become a two-weight world champion. You know, I believe I'm going to win this fight on December 18th. You know, I believe I'm going to come through it in style. You know, I'm going to do really well in that fight. And my longer term goals would be, you know, to move up to 147 and chase some of these bigger fights. You know, your Errol Spence's, your Dennis Ugas's, your Keith Thurman's, your Sean Porter's. These are all massive names in boxing. And, you know, these are all big fights, good big money fights for myself as well, life-changing money, set myself up and my family financially for the rest of my life. And, you know, it's, these are goals and ambitions that, you know, I want to do. You know, I want to make sure I can look after my family, but also I want to go down and remembered as one of the greatest Scottish fighters ever to have ever done it, you know, to become a two-weight world champion and be obviously undisputed now, but a Scottish undisputed two-weight world champion. That sounds unbelievable.
One man who seems not maybe to be obsessed, that would be a bit much, but one man who can't help himself from talking about you certainly a lot recently is Teofimo Lopez, and he seems more vocal than most. He wants a bit of a pop at you. Is he someone, again, and I appreciate coming back to what Rob said, you focus on the here and now, but in longer term plans, has he got the skill set, is he someone that you would be interested in going toe-to-toe with?
I think that's a good fight to be made, but ultimately I think I take up my bits. he's a good fighter, but I think he's a little bit delusional. You know, he's just talking. He's saying he's undisputed champion. He's finished his business at lightweight, whether he hasn't. You know, he's had one good win against Lomachenko, albeit a very good win. You know, you got to give credit where credit's due. It was a very, very good win. But it's the only notable win that he's had. And Lomachenko was injured. He had a shoulder injury. So he's kind of ducking the other fights at 135. You know, Devin Haney's, your Ryan Garcia's, and your Tank Davis's. There's a lot of big fights for him at 135. I don't think he's the best of the bunch there. But having said that, if he comes up and the fight does happen eventually, then yeah, I'm more than happy to take him in bits and give him a doing. Yeah,
give us a sense, Josh. Going up 7 pounds to 147. How big of a gap is that in terms of bridging and ensuring that the skill set remains sharp enough at that weight, that the power output, that the energy output is still effective at that weight? Is it something that's really quite difficult to grapple with, or is it simply a case of tweaking a couple of things and you move on up and you pretty much stay the same?
It's not. I don't think I would need to change too much. I've got the size for it, the body frame for it, the strength, the natural strength for it. What I could afford to do is put on a little bit of muscle and a little bit of strength. I've got a lot of room to wiggle with that, you know. I've got a lot of size and strength to put on. And that would be the only thing, was to be a little bit stronger. And I think I would probably make the weight a little bit easier. It's only 7 pounds. I'm naturally walk around about 12 stone, where I've got to get down to 10 stone. So I'd be 10 stone 7, so it would be a little bit easier to make the weight. And I would be a lot healthier and more natural at the weight. So I'd be bigger and stronger, and I'd probably perform a little even better.
So give me a time frame on that. And I appreciate you've got a team, and Ben, who we caught up with yesterday, he'd have a big say in that. But a timeline for you then, assuming that you get past Jack Catterall, I'm assuming you will, and I'm backing you to do just that, continue to fly the flag for Scotland, Josh. A timeline of where you might look to kind of step up to the 147.
I'm not sure. You know, it's not definite. You know, we'll have to do this after the next fight. It's not definite that I'm definitely going to jump up after the next fight. You know, it's just an option that we can go. You know, there's still massive fights at 140. You know, I've got big fights there in defending my titles if I want to do that. But ultimately, for me to set my goals and go and achieve my new goals, is to step up after the fight and spend a bit of time getting stronger, going to the gym, lifting a bit of weights, putting a bit of strength, sort of build up. So it'd be a few months in that process, straight into the gym and building in my strength and getting stronger. So I would like to maybe, I'd probably box again, maybe in the May of next year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just sort of a couple of months and then get a fight at 147 and then chase a title fight, hopefully.
The Offscript Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.